This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
So, Kretsche, was darf ich heute tätowieren?
Eine Flasche. Aber nicht dich, sondern von Spreequell.
Was?
Ja, ich mache jetzt Werbung für die. Das muss verewigt werden.
Klassik oder naturell?
Spreequell aktiv. Das mit den Früchten.
Und wo?
Na, überall.
Nee, ich meine das Tattoo.
Trink Spreequell aktiv. Jetzt zuckerfrei.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The new government says its overarching objective is economic growth. All else depends upon it. It also believes that one huge impediment to growth is the way the planning system has inhibited essential development in the last few years. In recent days, it's announced plans to change all that. So, is it true that our planning system has held us back? If so, why and how? What policies would be needed to properly reform it? And what price might we pay for those policies? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To take me through all those questions are Sir John Armitt, who is chairman of the UK's National Infrastructure Commission, Katrina Riddell, who's an independent planning consultant and commentator who advises on planning policy, and Anthony Breach, Associate Director at Centre for Cities. Anthony Breach, can we start with you giving me a brief potted history of planning in the UK?
Right after the Second World War in 1947, we introduced the Town and Country Planning Act, which takes on quite a different path to planning to what we'd done before, and indeed what other countries around the world decide to do. So we introduce a discretionary system in which councils have the power to decide whether or not development should be allowed to go ahead.
Do you mean that before that, they didn't have that power? The government would say, this is what's going to happen in your area?
Pretty much. It's more that kind of landowners had development rights themselves, so they could decide what to build on their own land. That became much more discretionary after this new system was introduced. Then in the 1950s, you have the introduction of the Greenbelt that restricts the growth of cities going outwards. Then in the 1960s and 70s, you have the introduction of various restrictions that make it difficult for cities to go upwards. And so we've had a kind of sudden and then gradual tightening of the planning system ever since the end of the Second World War.
Katrina, what would you add to that in terms of the kind of planning landmarks since the war?
I think I would probably change the narrative a little bit more there, because I think from the late 60s, planning became the main tool for growth. They introduced regional planning. They introduced a bigger form of planning to actually direct the growth of cities. And actually, that's when the Greenbelt was much more of a tool for growth as well, because although it was to constrain the outward sprawl of cities, it was also to direct growth to new towns, new settlements. It was also to allow for new infrastructure. So we had the M25, for example. So I think probably between the 60s in about 2010, planning was a tool for positive growth, positive place shaping.
Let me understand this with regard to the Green Belt. So we could look at the Green Belt in both of two ways. One, that it restricts cities, but second, that it actually enables growth elsewhere by effectively kind of directing it.
Yeah, it had two sort of main purposes in terms of that period. One was to direct growth to where the infrastructure was being planned for, not just motorways, but train lines, new stations, etc. So that's where you had Milton Keynes coming about and all the other generation of new towns. But it also had a really important role in terms of regeneration. So we had all the changing land uses throughout that period as well, during the post-war period, especially industrial land. So it actually forced the redevelopment of these sites. It didn't make it too easy to shift out to the greenfield sites. So it had a really important role in terms of that wider regeneration of the big cities and towns.
John, can you negotiate our way through? Because we have two essentially slightly differing pictures, though I think that they can come together. One of the restriction on planning, effectively, that the discretionary system creates, and then Katrina's picture of the regional planning and so on. Where do we end up?
We end up increasingly with more controls. There's no doubt about that. And those controls, to a certain extent, have become more complex. And so in order to try and enable infrastructure, particularly large-scale infrastructure, we saw in 2008 the introduction of the NSIP process, which
meant
Nationally Significant Infrastructure Projects, which had their own regime, which was to essentially initially to give powers to an independent inspector. That only lasted 2 or 3 years, and then government thought, hey-ho, we ought to be making the final decision. So they took back the final decision back into government. Essentially, it's a good process. Back in 2012, it was taking about 2.5 years to get through the process. Today, it's taking over 4 years to get through the process. And in fact, as has been observed more recently, back in 2012, 10% of projects went to judicial review. And more recently, 60% of projects have gone
60,
to,
from 10 60, to 60.
From 10 to 60. That, of course, discourages investors. And actually, on the other hand, it encourages people to put more and more things into the project in order to avoid being caught by judicial review. So up goes the cost of the projects as you try and second guess what is going to be objected to.
I see. So you say essentially it's a kind of form of buying off the objections by saying we'll put more stuff into this despite not always being able to afford it.
Exactly, and hoping you'll avoid judicial review. But the fact that we've gone to 60% would suggest that even that hasn't been successful.
Right. How do we explain, Anthony, this incredible change from very little going to judicial review to lots going to judicial review?
I think there are factors that are specific to the infrastructure planning regime, which is quite different from your garden variety town planning, which is for houses, for offices and for factories. But I think more broadly, over that kind of 60, 70-year period since the modern planning system has been introduced, politicians have been trying to grapple with the political questions of how do we deal with objections to development? How do we deal with objections to growth, either at local level or indeed at the national level? And I think there has been a bit of an impulse by politicians to try and think, well, if we give a little bit more power, a little bit more little give and take towards some of these opponents of growth, maybe that will secure some buy-in for new infrastructure, for new development. In practice, I think that political strategy hasn't really worked, and this kind of discretionary case-by-case decision-making where we're making basically economic decisions as if they are judicial decisions, right? As if, you know, these are kind of court cases or kind of almost criminal cases that we're deciding, you know, whether houses or train lines should be built. It hasn't really addressed the objections or kind of the low opinions people have of development, but it hasn't increased development either.
Do you have any big examples in mind of just that process taking place?
I think kind of HS2 is the classic one, right? You know, it's an enormously expensive railway project. Part of that expense has come from the fact that lots and lots of mitigation has been introduced early into the process in the attempt to kind of stave off objections. So we've tunneled through the Chilterns at great expense. We've had all kinds of planning conditions attached to that development, but it hasn't really mitigated the opponents of HS2. We haven't really seen many people who said, well, I opposed HS2 before it was going underground the Chilterns, but now it is, it's totally fine. You know, that political change hasn't really happened.
John, you were smiling at that, which I thought you obviously kind of recognise that as a syndrome. Before we go on, can we just talk about what we mean when we talk about planning that's important to economic growth? There's an awful lot of discussion about housing primarily. Can you tell us what the contribution of housing development is to economic growth, and what's the contribution of other projects that we might conceivably build?
Housing, by its very nature, is, of course, is growth. It's jobs, it's employment, and it creates opportunity. It also, if you densify it, in fact, can reduce carbon, because the closer people live together, the less distance they've got to travel. You can get more agglomeration. And so it was welcome news to see the government in the last couple of days say that it was going to encourage densification, particularly in brownfield and regeneration opportunities. In a wider sense, of course, transport has always been recognised as enabling economic growth. The easier it is to get from A to B. I mean, if you compare British cities with European cities, most European cities, people can get into the centre in under a half an hour from their homes. That is not so much the case here. It takes longer than half an hour. So you're wasting time, you're getting more congestion, you're getting more carbon. So the transport system within a city, and that's why we suppose more and more mass transit systems, if you've got a good public transport system in a city, that leads to growth, it leads to activity, and it enables people to get around their daily lives in an easy way.
Katrina, let's talk about who's responsible for planning and how that's developed. You were talking about national planning, you were talking about regional planning and so on. Can you just tell us roughly who's responsible for what?
Yeah, and actually that's the question around where we went wrong, because I think in 2010, everything fundamentally changed, because up until that point, central government took a lot of responsibility. So although we had regional planning and we had other types of strategic planning, that larger than local planning, ultimately the decision, the ownership was from central government. So local authorities and other stakeholders developed the plans, but it was government that actually owned the plans at the end of the day. When we got to 2010, we had localism introduced, and effectively central government abdicated all responsibility for the difficult decisions. So up until that point, we had housing numbers developed and assessed at a higher level, green belt reviews at a higher level, big infrastructure that didn't really fit within the national infrastructure. So water reservoirs, for example, were decided at that sort of regional strategic level. So post 2010, central government decided localism was in, local authorities were going to be making all the decisions, and you're asking, on the most part, very small councils with councillors who live and breathe their local community to make really difficult decisions in the interest of the greater good. And that's where it all fell apart, because central government didn't want to make these decisions, and they disguised it as localism, but it was basically saying, we don't want to make the decisions. You also had two different things coming into play at that point. You had social media coming in, lots more effective campaigning through social media now, which make it even harder for councillors to make difficult decisions. And you had an increasing number of councillors who were independent resident associations who had come from that campaigning anti-planning platform into being in a decision-making role. And a lot of the councils have elections every year. So you've got councils making decisions from sort of May election to October every single year. So the balance between central government and local government totally changed post 2010. And that's hopefully what we saw recently.
Anthony.
The structure of local government is a really big problem that's upstream of a lot of these planning problems. I mean, the structure we have is so higgledy-piggledy, it's such a mess. It's really difficult to get local government, local authorities to absorb the planning responsibilities that they have. So I'll give you an example. Local plans that decide where houses go are decided by district councils, whereas local transport plans that decide where infrastructure goes are decided by county councils. And obviously those two things are meant to communicate with each other, but equally obviously they don't. And it's actually a huge bottleneck to getting spatial planning, strategic planning, lining up new housing with infrastructure, is the fact that our local government system just isn't joined up in the way that it should be.
We have a couple of problems there, which is that we have overlapping responsibilities which actually don't mesh. And we also have what sounds very much to me, John, like a NIMBY's charter, to use that kind of crude word. I mean, it's not maybe the most useful word, but people will understand it, which is it's easier actually in a sense to object to something than it is to get something built.
Well, of course, some of the objecting voices are normally the loudest in any situation. So the majority of the people who might support something don't get very active about it. They just assume that it's going to happen. Those who are very opposed will be very active and get their action groups together. Just come back to the NSIP process, Nationally Significant Infrastructure Projects, though, because that was meant to address the issue of decisions being made at a higher level for these nationally significant projects, that in a sense enables the local community or the local councils to represent their views to the inspector. But at the end of the day, they do not make the decision. The recommendation is made by the inspector to the minister, and the minister then has to essentially within 5 months make his pronouncement on accepting or not accepting the decision made by the planning inspector. So when that works, that can in fact be very effective and enable those major projects, which are so critical in terms of the energy requirements and our change to electrification, the amount of new renewable energy that we've got to build, the fact that we're running out of water and looking forward, we've got to build more reservoirs. These major schemes are totally dependent on the NSIP process.
Can we just talk about now what's effectively stopped us from implementing? I imagine that successive governments have also seen that they've got a problem, Katrina, and they've also seen they wanted to do something about it. And I seem to remember that this was actually a major factor for Boris Johnson when he was Prime Minister. What have been the obstacles in the way of changing the planning regime?
So the main obstacle since 2010, they abolished any form of larger than local planning in any effective way. They abolished the bit that made the decisions on key issues around Greenbelt, on strategic infrastructure, on housing numbers. So they got rid of that. And that's meant that for the last 14 years, that decision process hasn't happened. So we are supposed to have a plan-led system where so local plans make all the decisions up front, and then the decision-making process through applications is much shorter, a lot less convoluted, a lot less complicated. But what we've got is less than a third of coverage of local plans now, because local councils can't progress the plans because they're having to make these really difficult decisions individually. And as Ant says, you've also got the complications in two-tier systems. You've also got, on top of that, resourcing, a huge issue, not just in terms of local authorities, but all the government agencies, the Environment Agency, Natural England, National Highways, all huge factors in terms of the slowing down of planning.
Right. Anthony, can you tell us how the planning regime differs between here and in other countries? And also, can you alert us to whether there are actually any differences within the UK in the planning regimes?
Yeah, so there's not many differences within the UK. There are small differences, but they're pretty minor. But the UK system is really quite different from those we see elsewhere around the world. So in most other developed countries, we have zoning systems where essentially, if you follow the rules, then you can build. Our system is not that logical. We have a system where even if you follow the rules, you can still be denied planning permission. So that's the discretionary element that's within our system. Now, there are rules and kind of guidelines about what you can and cannot reject as a council, but councils really have quite a lot of latitude to deny planning consents to schemes that they find objectionable. So you can get quite advanced and far in a process and find that your entire scheme or your project has just gone down the toilet because local councillors have decided that they don't like it.
Can we take an example of something that, say, would be happening in Europe or America that actually would be very difficult to do here?
So I think New Zealand's actually the best example. Since the middle of the 2010s, we saw Auckland and then New Zealand nationally have implemented planning changes that have made it much easier to build small semi-detached houses within urban limits of places. And that's been done by a simple change to their rules. And now that the rules have changed, if you make a proposal that complies with those rules, you can build more houses. And it's been shown in quite a number of papers by this point that that's resulted in more houses being built, that's resulted in cheaper rents, that's resulted in slower house price growth, and that's kind of all followed like clockwork. In our system, that's not as nearly easy to do, because even if you change the rules in our system, that doesn't necessarily result in an increase in supply, because systems are still discretionary.
John, can we just talk about one psychological element that might help explain this hostility towards development and planning, which is, and I put it to you tentatively, what was done in the 60s. Major developments, which were then subsequently seen, housing developments, motorways through cities developments, which were subsequently seen as big errors and which may have fostered a kind of psychological hostility.
Those were, I suppose, typical of their time. We thought in the late 50s and through the 60s that the motor car was the future, and therefore life would revolve around the motor car. And if certain plans had gone ahead, places like the Strand would have become elevated motorways, motorways at ground level, and we would have been walking around at a high level, above the traffic, so the separation of traffic from pedestrian. And that became a dominant theme. Now, a lot of opposition ensured that it didn't happen. And so in London, Westway is about the only example that we have of that proposal. The trouble is these things do go through fashions. You could say that at the moment we are well and truly into the understanding of congestion carbon decarbonisation. That is what drives our thinking at the moment. And when it comes to planning, what is really important is that the government issues what are called national policy statements, because those national policy statements, kept up to date, given to, for example, planning inspectors, can give a very clear direction of travel as to what needs to be approved, what almost should have an expectation of approval, subject, of course, to it meeting some broad rules. There's no doubt that a rules-based system is easier, particularly in the UK, where so much of our infrastructure is provided by the private sector. So you've got to get investors in. Investors like certainty, they like stability, they like continuity. And if they can't see that within a British system, then there's plenty of other places, New Zealand one, but many others, where they'll take their money and invest instead.
Katrina, I think that brings us up to the here and now. I mean, the Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, announced some changes to the planning rules recently. Can you briefly summarise the main changes?
So the main changes are a return to a sort of more effective approach to that strategic sub-regional planning that was abolished in 2010, and that will reintroduce a way of trying to make difficult decisions easier, I think. But it's also a way of trying to deal with building that investor confidence, you know, providing long-term plans around where growth should go and how the government will support that. So that's really important in terms of building long-term investor confidence, whether we're talking about housing, dealing with net zero, dealing with transport or other economic infrastructure. So that's the first one. The second one is around the well-trailed increase in housing targets. And there's been a huge hike across England, apart from London, where there's been a reduction of about 18 to 20% in their target. So there's been a big hike, particularly across the northern areas. I think the northeast got a doubling of its housing targets. And underpinning that is a slightly more permissive regime around things like Greenbelt, which surrounds a lot of the cities. And we've heard a lot about Greybelt, which is...
Greybelt,
which sits within Greenbelt. And we've all been waiting with bated breath around what that actually means. I'm not convinced we really understand yet what it is, but the idea is that it will deliver more housing, and importantly, it will improve existing grotty bits of Greenbelt and deliver a lot more affordable housing. And then on top of that, and I think this is where we've got to see this as a package, it's not just recent reforms through policy, it's about the new legislation announced in the King's speech, a lot of different things that is hopefully going to make it easier to make decisions.
Katrina, we always talk about affordable housing. What is it?
So that has changed over the years. In the last sort of 14 years, it has shifted much more towards slightly lower cost market housing. And that was the last government's definition. So we had things like new homes introduced. So it was specifically targeting people that couldn't afford the full market value. And a lot of that's around the southeast, the very high house prices around the southeast. What Labour, I think, are trying to do is get back to something more akin to council housing, so social rented. So it's saying we actually, there's this whole raft since we had Right to Buy in the late 1970s and we lost all our council housing. So they're proposing some big shifts back to that sort of approach. So it's genuinely affordable to people who haven't got access to mortgages or to market rent. And that's where I think the affordability definition, I think, will change quite significantly.
John, we've talked a lot about housing here. Let's talk a bit about what you can see from what's been announced so far in the non-housing areas of liberalising or making planning easier for the purposes of building things.
Well, the obvious one which the government has announced is that it's going to bring onshore wind farms into the NSIP process as long as they're bigger than 100 megawatt projects. Now, onshore wind is one of the cheapest forms of renewable energy, so that will enable us to... achieve the sort of levels of renewable energy that we need to create in the country. So that's one significant difference which the announcements have made. And I think the government has also recognised that it's got to get to grips with the planning system to enable these major infrastructure projects to have more certainty. They've accepted our recommendation about updating the national policy statements. A lot of projects actually go through the same environmental considerations all over again from a previous project which has done exactly the same analysis. Those analyses can take several years, and yet we don't seem to say, well, that was good enough here. We're now 20 miles down the road, very similar circumstances. Why can't we take what we agreed and understood there and move it across to here? So creating a database of information which enables that to be carried forward.
Can we talk Anthony, about some of the trade-offs here? They're actually pretty obvious in some ways. Let me give you an example. MPs are local MPs. They're always under pressure to reject unpopular developments in their areas. So we've had lots of governments, a situation whereby the government will say, our policy is this. And you even have ministers saying, yes, but not in my constituency. And it happens. And then the thing gets defeated and so on. There is a huge level of trouble ahead, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think this is where the planning system and its discretionary element is a really poison chalice for politicians, right? It gives them control over applications and new development. In return, they have to accept responsibility for that, including from voters who may or may not like it. If we shifted towards a more rules-based system where it was clearer what was protected and was not protected and what developments would be allowed and would not be allowed, I think a lot of the toxicity and aggro of the planning system could be drained out.
You mean the MP could go back to the campaign group saying, I'm terribly sorry, you know, however much I might sympathise with you, this is a national decision. So the Green MP for Waveney, who currently doesn't want the pylons coming from the offshore wind, would just have to turn round to his constituents and say, not down to me, Gov, I've made my representations, but actually, John.
The other suggestion that's been made is that more consideration be given to the impact on those people who don't benefit from that national infrastructure, which is going to go past their community. So to what extent can you compensate them in some financial way, probably, or in lower bills, that they are putting up with something which is going to impact them, but the direct benefit is felt by many people hundreds of miles away. Of course, there have been some smaller areas where, in fact, people part-own the local wind turbine, and they actually benefit with low electricity and are engaged almost as part-owners in that, and they've found it much more acceptable when it's something that they're involved with. But I think there's another aspect to all of this, which is that we don't really have a proper discussion, an open discussion about why we need to do all of this, that this is about jobs, this is about growth, it's about future opportunity, it's about having a resilient system, it's about reducing the carbon impact, to reduce the impacts of climate change. Now, everybody says they want those things. Well, on the other hand, but please don't inconvenience me by being part of that solution. And so I think we've got to have a more honest discussion and talk about what happens if we don't do things so much as what happens when we do things. Because if we don't do things, we're going to fall into some horrible traps in the future. And I think we all have a responsibility to open up and engage in that discussion with the population at large.
Katrina, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think we have to have, it's back to, you know, about what is planning, is its role to support growth, and the narrative that we've had over the last few years around it being the thing that stops things happening when actually it was invented to create good places and to support growth. And I think we've lost that whole debate, and it hasn't been helped by the, you know, planners being labelled as enemies of enterprise and things like that. And the YIMBY NIMBY debate, you know, not in my backyard, yes in my backyard. They are sort of all polarised views. We've got an awful lot of people that don't have a say, that sit in the middle, that want to have a positive debate. So I think John's absolutely right. We need to have this positive debate, but also allow government to make government decisions in the interests of the nation. Mm-hmm. That is really, really important.
Anthony. Having looked at the government's plans, do you think that they will actually help deliver the economic growth, which actually underpins everything else the government wants to do?
So I think what the government's proposed recently, I think, will make an improvement to the planning system that will improve economic growth. However, they're what I would call small R planning reforms, right, to the existing system, rather than big R planning reforms to move to a new planning system like other developed countries have. So you can kind of see this in how quickly they've done it, right? This has all been in the first 100 days, all kind of introduced with strokes of pens, introducing things or cutting things out. Actually, a lot of the real problems in the planning system sit deep within legislation. That's why this new planning bill they're going to be introducing is so important, and why they've got to get that right to get the economic strategy right.
John.
There's talk of a national infrastructure strategy from the government, which would be very important. If that is also zonally and spatially planned, because that's very important, there are certain parts of the country which are the only parts of the country where, for example, it would be wise to develop carbon capture storage, which is very critical infrastructure going forward, or hydrogen production going forward. There are zones in the country where government can make decisions and can take the lead in the next few months, which would actually give some certainty to that. It'll require a bit of seed funding. But really, I think the key thing for government and the challenge that government faces here is the criticality of the next 25 years is so high in terms of resilience, in terms of dealing with decarbonisation and dealing with economic growth, that we have to find ways through this system of putting the nation first over and above the local interest. And that is politically challenging, but if we can't do that, then it will be difficult.
John Armitt there with Katrina Riddell and Anthony Breach. And my conclusion? There may be trouble ahead. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about the state of the UK water industry, the one about what's happening in Sudan, and the three about the future of health. The Briefing Room will be back next week at an earlier time of 9 a.m. for the first in a three-part series looking at potential global flashpoints. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter and Kirsty Knight. The editor was Penny Murphy, and the sound engineers were Neil Churchill and Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Carlo Gabler from BBC Radio 4, and the history podcast, This Is Escape from the Maze, the disturbing inside story of the biggest jailbreak in British and Irish history.
It's a major aberration. It's no different from an IRA aberration, I'd say.
Told by the people who carried it out and the people who tried to stop them.
The staff were terrorised, obviously having difficulty breathing.
It's an escape planned in forensic detail.
It's a need-to-know basis, and if you don't need to know, you don't know.
That creates shockwaves at the heart of government.
It is a very grave incident indeed, the most serious in our prison history.
Find Escape from the Maze on the History Podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.